Cavanaugh wasn't sure when he had come up with the plan of going to Philadelphia to see Mr. Theodore Epson. But the more he thought of it, the better the idea became. He'd get more money from Epson. He figured losing an ear should be worth a hell of a lot more money. And if Epson thought otherwise, then all Cavanaugh would have to do is go to the law with the letter Epson had sent him. Cavanaugh wasn't even sure where Philadelphia was, though he had a vague suspicion that one could get there, or nearly so, by taking a riverboat. The steamboat came into view shortly after Cavanaugh heard the whistle. Cavanaugh put his hand over the bandaged ear and walked down to the docks to wait for it. There was no one ashore selling tickets, but the moment he stepped on board, the purser arranged his passage for him. He found out from the purser that the boat couldn't take him all the way to Philadelphia, as he had hoped, but he would take him as far as he could. Once they were underway, Cavanaugh walked to the bow of the boat and watched the river roll underneath. He had never been to Philadelphia. He had never been to any city larger than St. Louis. He wondered if they had whorehouses in Philadelphia. Jeb Law had his back to the bar as he was putting bottles of whiskey in their place. What do you have that isn't poison? Jeb didn't turn around.
Ain't you ever heard the temperance lectures, mister? It's all poison. Some of it is just quicker than the other.
Well, if you got anything that won't eat through the glass before I can get it down, I'll have a drink. This time, Jeb recognized the voice, and he turned around, then smiled broadly as he stuck his hand across the bar.
Good God! Art! Well, if you ain't a sight for tired old eyes.
Damnation! Ha! Hello, Jeb. What are you doing in Westport?
It's Kansas City now.
Jeb reached under the bar to pull out a special bottle to pour Preacher's drink.
Nobody calls it Westport anymore. Come to think of it, nobody calls you Art anymore either, do they? It's Preacher, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the handle folks seem to have hung on me.
Things change.
Yeah, last time I saw you, you was trapping.
Like I said, things change. Here, this one's on the house.
I'll let you buy me the first one, then I'll buy us both one.
Sounds good enough to me. What brings you to Kansas City? You don't come this far east all that often. From what I hear, you're about as fixed in those mountains as one of them aspen trees.
Well, I'm on my way to St. Louis. Thought I might find a place to board my string here, then take a boat.
What have you got?
A good riding horse, two good pack animals.
How long you planning on being gone?
Well, that's just it. I don't know as I can answer that question.
That ain't like you not to have a clear plan of what you're going to do.
Oh, I got me a clear plan of what I'm going to do, all right. I just don't know how long it's going to take for me to do it.
Sounds a little mysterious.
Jeb picked up his glass and held it out toward Preacher.
Here's to you, my friend.
And old times.
Now, what is it you're planning on doing, if you don't mind me asking?
I reckon you heard about what happened to Jenny.
Jenny? You talking about the pretty little gal used to run the House of Flowers back in St. Louis?
Yeah.
No, don't know as I've heard anything about her lately.
She's dead, Jeb.
Dead? Oh, the hell you say? That's a damn shame. She was a fine woman, for all that she was a whore. Wait a minute. You set some store by her, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I set quite a store by her.
I'm real sorry to hear about her dying. She come down with something, did she?
She was murdered.
Murdered?
Without being told, Jeb reached under the bar, pulled out the bottle, and refilled their glasses one more time.
Does anyone know who done it?
I got a letter from Mr. Ashley. He thinks Cavanaugh may have had something to do with it.
Cavanaugh? Ben Cavanaugh?
Yeah.
That bastard. His partner was Percy McDill. I remember the night McDill tried to force himself on Jenny. Lucky for her, you was there. Son of a bitch, Cavanaugh snuck away like a mangy dog he is while you were fighting McDill. So you planning on going after him?
Oh, yeah.
And what you gonna do with your string again?
I don't know. Sell them or board them.
I'll keep your animals for you. If you don't come back by next season, I'll sell them and hold the money for you. After taking out what it took me to feed them.
I appreciate that.
Now, what do you say I shut this place down for a while and me and you go to the Blue Hole Cafe and have us some supper?
Well, that sounds good to me. The enticing aroma of pork cooking over a hickory fire drifted down the street to them even before they reached the cafe known as Blue Hole. Blue Hole was a wood-frame building with a shake roof and a wide plank floor. The cooking pit was just behind the building, and the aromatic smoke the cooking produced was the best advertisement the cafe had. A large woman, known as Aunt Molly, greeted Preacher and Jeb when they came into the cafe. Two men passed them on their way out.
Howdy, Jeb.
There was only one empty table, and it was covered with leftover bones, but Aunt Molly led them to it, scooped up the bones, and used a soiled cloth to wipe the table.
Ooh, who's your young, good-looking friend?
This here's Preacher.
Aunt Molly looked at Preacher with interest.
Preacher? You a man of the cloth?
No, ma'am.
Oh, heavens, are you that mountain man folks call Preacher?
That's who he is, all right.
You're getting yourself quite a reputation. They say you're the ridin'est, shootin'est, fightin'est, trappin'est, dancin'est, handsomest man in all the mountains. I don't know about all the rest, but I'll vouch for the handsome part. I'm right pleased to meet you, Preacher.
Well, I'm very pleased to meet you.
What have you got this good, Aunt Molly?
We got some ribs just ready to come off. Don't tell me you ain't smelling them.
Oh, the whole town is smelling them.
Well, I certainly hope so.
Tell you what, how about you bring us a side of ribs, some beans, bread, and coffee?
Help yourself to the coffee, and I'll go back to get the ribs.
As Aunt Molly headed out back, Jeb walked over to the coffee pot, where he poured two cups. He returned to the table, a steaming mug in each hand. Three men were having a conversation at a hitching rail just up the street from the Blue Hole. One was tall, with a very dark, scraggly beard. The other two were somewhat shorter and clean-shaven. They had just left the Blue Hole. The tall, bearded man had an evil look in his eyes.
Are you sure it's Preacher, George?
Oh, it's him, all right. I mind seeing him at a rendezvous a year or so back.
The tall man stroked his beard and smiled.
Well, now, looks like I just got me a streak of luck, don't it?
Luke took out his pistol and began loading and charging it.
Luke, I sure hope you know what you're doing, going after Preacher like this. I heard of him. They say he's one slippery fella to try to get a hold of.
I ain't planning on dancing with the son of a bitch, so I won't be trying to get a hold of him. I just plan on putting a ball in his brain. Now, are you men with me or not?
We ain't got no quarrel with him.
I didn't have no quarrel with Roland Peters either. But when you two went up against him last year, I was with you.
Roland Peters wasn't no Preacher.
If there's three of us go after the son of a bitch, there's no way he can handle us all. Al, he's only got one charge in his pistol.
George looked at his partner. Smaller man nodded.
All right, we'll back you. But you're the one's gonna have to call him out.
Don't worry. I'll do that, all right.
Back in the Blue Hole Cafe, Preacher had chosen the chair that faced the front of the cafe, which meant that Jeb had his back to the door.
You know anything else about Miss Jenny getting murdered? I mean, did the letter tell you how it happened? Why it happened? Anything like that?
This is all I know. Preacher took Ashley's letter from a pocket and handed it across the table to Jeb. Jeb took out a pair of spectacles, fitted them carefully over one ear at a time, then read the letter. Concentrated on it for a moment.
I'm real sorry to hear about that.
Jeb handed the letter back.
I didn't really know her at all that well. Did Miss Jenny have any family as you know about?
Nobody that I knew about. I reckon me and her friend Carla's about the only ones that she was really close to. Looking toward the front door, the patrons of the cafe saw that a tall man with a black, scraggly beard just stepped inside.
Where's the one they called Preacher?
The man was holding his hand down by his side. The preacher saw at once that there was a pistol in his hand. And even from where he sat, he could see that the pistol was cocked. He could only assume that it was also primed. That'd be me.
My name is Luke Mouchette. That name mean anything to you?
Jeb, I reckon you better move away. Instead of moving out of the way, Jeb turned toward the intruder.
Look here, Mr. Mouchette. I don't know what this is all about, but...
Jeb, get the hell out of the way now!
Jeb got up from the table and walked over to the side of the room. He wasn't the only one to move. Every other table in the cafe emptied. The patrons left their food on the tables and scrambled to get out of the way.
You didn't answer me, Preacher. Have you heard my name before?
Yeah, I heard it.
Where have you heard it?
Oh, I knew a low-assed, mealy-mouthed, maggot-infested son of a bitch by the name of Mouchette. Why? Is there some kind of family connection?
He was my brother, and you killed him, you son of a bitch.
He needed killing.
Yeah, well, so do you!
The shot had come not from Mouchette's gun, but from under Preacher's table. The ball plunged into Mouchette's chest and he staggered back toward the door. From just outside the cafe, George saw Luke stagger back and fall onto the porch.
Shit!
With his own pistol drawn, George started toward the front door. There was a large hole in the table where Preacher had been sitting. Preacher stood then, and as he did so, everyone could see that he was holding a smoking pistol in his hand.
How the hell did you do that?
Preacher didn't respond to Jeb's question. Instead, moving quickly, he hurried to the front door and stood to one side of it. A man came running in.
You son of a...
Preacher hit him right between the eyes with the butt of his own pistol. Preacher dropped his gun and grabbed George's. Rearmed, Preacher stepped out the front door.
Damn shame you missed!
With no other adversaries on the scene, Preacher stepped back inside, still holding the smoking gun. He tossed it to one side, picked up his own spent weapon, and walked back over to the table, aware of everyone staring at him in shock and awe. Aunt Molly was standing by the table holding a plate of ribs, her eyes wide, shocked expression on her face. Smoke from the discharges gathered in a billowing cloud under the ceiling. Quickly and carefully, Preacher reloaded his pistol.
Oh, God.
The man Preacher had knocked out was just coming to, and he stood up, shook his head a few times, and slunk away, leaving the cafe behind him, just as another man stepped into the cafe, and he had an air of authority. He was also wearing a shiny tin star.
What happened here?
My friend didn't have no choice, Sheriff. Three men came in gunning for him.
You know why?
Yeah, I killed that one's brother.
Where'd you do that?
At Rendezvous out in the Rockies.
Trappers is normally pretty straight about things. If you killed them at Rendezvous and they let you go, you was probably in the right. Besides which, ain't no concern of mine what happened out there. And if all these folks say you was in the right here, I don't plan to do nothing about this either.
Well, thank you.
I'd appreciate it, though, if you'd put the gun away.
Preacher stared at his pistol for a moment, then stuck it back in his belt. The sheriff looked at Aunt Molly.
I'll get the undertaker down here to pull the body off your front porch.
No worry. Long as he's out here, folks will come have a look. And when they do, why, they'll just naturally want to come in and have dinner.
Lord, I hope not, Aunt Molly. Else you'll be dragging anyone get shot down here.
The sheriff tipped his hat to Molly, gave one last look at Preacher, and walked out of the cafe.
I'm sorry about the table, Molly. If you tell me how much it is, I'll pay to have another one built for you.
I reckon a dollar will pay for your food and fix the table.
Preacher pulled out a silver dollar and handed it to her, then reached for the plate of ribs.
Thanks. This looks good.
The second day into Cabanis's trip, he was standing at the railing when the captain and two deckhands approached him.
Mister, you want to tell us how you lost that ear?
Cabanis put his hand to the bandaged wound on the side of his face.
What business is of yours how I lost it?
Well, you see, the thing is, some of our passengers are from St. Louis. According to them, there was a young woman murdered there recently. But it turns out, she had a dog who defended her. Dog bit the ear off her attacker.
Yeah, well, I don't know nothing about that. I got this ear bit off by a bear.
That may be, but I intend to put you in irons until we get to Cape Girardeau. There, I'll turn you over to the constable. He can take you back up to St. Louis until you get all this worked out.
As the men started toward him, Cabanis hesitated only for a moment. Then he climbed onto the rail and leapt down into the Mississippi River.
That son of a bitch is getting away!
The two deckhands ran over to the railing and looked into the river. They could only see the roiling water. No sign of a man without an ear.
I think we can forget about him, boys. The currents and eddies are so strong right through here, it's damn near impossible to swim. More than likely, he's drowned already. Good riddance! He was a guilty one, all right, otherwise he wouldn't have jumped over like that.
Preacher booked passage from Kansas City to St. Louis on the steamboat Missouri Belle. He had enough money to afford first-class passage and could easily have occupied the most luxurious stateroom. The fact that he chose not to was due less to parsimony than to the fact that he was genuinely more comfortable on the open deck than in one of the fancy staterooms. While in Kansas City, Preacher got himself some new clothes, though his new duds, like those he'd gotten rid of, were made of buckskin. He rented a bathtub and got himself cleaned up, even going to a barber for a haircut and a shave. And as a result, he cut quite a handsome figure when he stepped aboard the Missouri Belle. Two of the passengers, Miss Emma Purdy and Miss Cynthia Kane, took note of him, smiling at him from behind the fans they were carrying. The two very pretty young ladies were from well-to-do families in Kansas City. Their families, believing that Kansas City was too provincial a town for them, were sending them to St. Louis for finishing school. Although the young women had noticed Preacher the moment he came on board, they made no effort to approach him, believing that he, like most other men they had encountered, would make the first move. When by evening of the second day it became obvious to them that he wasn't going to come to them, they approached him. Preacher was standing by the rail, looking at the shoreline. He had been through this country many times before and was sorry to see that even here, civilization was beginning to creep in. He saw farmhouses and cultivated land where on previous voyages up and down the river, there had been nothing but wilderness. He wondered how long it would be before civilization and all its ills encroached upon the West that he knew. Lost in thought, Preacher didn't hear the two women approach. They suddenly appeared, one on each side of him. Recovering quickly, Preacher smiled at him.
Good evening, ladies.
Good evening.
Nice view from here.
Yes, quite lovely. The captain said you are called Preacher, but he also said that you aren't really a preacher.
That's true.
I'm Emma Purdy.
I'm Cynthia Kane.
I'm pleased to meet you, ladies.
If you aren't a preacher, why do they call you Preacher?
Oh, it's just something that happened to me once.
Oh, please, do tell.
Well, it's a long story.
Well, it's a long time before we get to St. Louis.
Well, I guess it isn't that. All right, here goes. Preacher began telling of the time he had been a prisoner of the Blackfoot, with no chance of help or escape. From somewhere, an idea formed in his head, and he began to sermonize, speaking in the same style he had once heard used by an itinerant preacher on the waterfront in St. Louis. He preached like a born-again, water-baptized, true believer in the Lord Almighty.
Well, the Indians didn't understand what I was saying, but they listened anyway, and I continued to preach all through the night. Come the next morning, I was still preaching. I was amazed that I still had the strength to do it.
What were you preaching about?
I'll tell you the truth, I almost didn't even know what I was saying myself, but I kept on talking and kept on preaching. I preached all through the rest of that morning without stopping. People of the village, and men, women, and children, they gathered all around to listen, although they didn't have the slightest idea what I was saying. Finally, the elders of the village held a council where they decided I was crazy. Hell, maybe I was.
What do you mean, maybe you were? Do you think you were crazy?
Well, I might have been a little crazy at the time, yeah. I don't know. But here's the thing. The Indians think that anyone who's crazy is touched by the Great Spirit. See, they're afraid to do any harm to him because they don't want to offend the Great Spirit. The next thing you know, a couple of the old chiefs came over to me and untied me. I tell you, they didn't do it a minute too soon, too, because by then my mouth was parched and sore. My vision was so blurred I could barely see. I don't think I could have lasted more than another 5 or 10 minutes.
And they just let you go?
Yeah.
Oh, what a wonderful story.
Brothers Rance and Leon, sons of Angus Culpepper, owner of Culpepper Stage and Freight Lines, were making the trip to St. Louis on the same boat as Preacher. Because they, like Emma Purdy and Cynthia Kane, were occupying first-class accommodations, they considered those two young ladies to be their exclusive property by right of social position. Rance and Leon stood for a while at the rail, smoking their pipes and looking toward the flora and fauna of the riverbank as it slid past the boat. While there, they couldn't help but overhear the story Preacher had just told the two young women. Now they walked toward the stern of the boat.
What a lout. No doubt, this is the longest conversation the creature has ever had with any woman who wasn't a whore.
Probably including his own mother.
Do you mean he hasn't had a long conversation with her, Rance? Or do you mean that she is a whore?
He hasn't had a long conversation with her. And she probably is a whore.
You have to admit, that was some story told. Do you believe it was true?
No. Mountain men are known to be great storytellers. And liars.
He had the young ladies hanging on every word.
Yes, unfortunately he did. But it was obviously a story of self-aggrandizement, designed to make himself a hero in their eyes.
What I don't understand is why Miss Purdy and Miss Kane would allow him to talk to them in the first place. He is traveling steerage, and one wonders where he even got the money for that.
He is taking advantage of their innocence, and I am personally offended by that.
Yes. Mountain men are barely civilized. They spend months at a time with no company other than bears.
And no doubt the bears find the presence of such men to be an affront to their dignity.
He obviously has no sense of his proper place.
Perhaps before we reach St. Louis, we should teach him some manners.
Yes, but let's not hurry. If we are patient and observant, I am positive that the perfect opportunity will present itself.
The Missouri Belle carried two very long poles, called spars, at the bow of the boat. Whenever the boat got stuck on a sandbar, which was fairly often in the transit of a shallow river like the Missouri, those two poles would be put down to the river bottom at about a 45-degree angle. Then they were driven back by cable attached to a steam capstan. The result was a very powerful poling of the boat. That action was technically known as sparring, though as the poles looked like grasshopper legs when in the water, it was often referred to as grasshoppering. When they were 4 days out of Kansas City, they got stuck on a sandbar. It wasn't a bar they had blundered onto as a result of poor piloting, but a bar that covered the entire channel, and thus could not be avoided. Now their only hope lay in attempting to traverse the sandbar at its most advantageous part. The poles dug into the river bottom and strained and bent slightly. The boat crept forward. Finally, the poles became extended and the boat could go no further. The poles would have to be retracted and the operation repeated. Though Preacher had offered his help, the captain had explained that the best thing any of the passengers could do was stay the hell out of the way. Now Preacher was accommodating him on that request. The poles were reset and the operation started a second time. Again, the poles strained backwards, and again the boat started sliding forward. The poles bent as before, but suddenly, one of the cables snapped.
Look out!
Preacher dove toward Emma and Cynthia, taking them both down. The cable whizzed by over them and smashed through the flagpole, breaking it as cleanly as if it were no more than a matchstick.
Oh, Lord, help!
The operator of the capstan also dove to the deck just in time to avoid it. But because the capstan was still running, the cable continued to whip around, flaying and smashing everything in its path. The operator couldn't stand up because the cable was whipping over his head, which also meant he couldn't get to the throttle lever to shut down the capstan.
We gotta get that engine shut down! If that cable flies loose and hits the boiler, we're gonna have one hell of an explosion!
The cable continued to whirl about, but as some of the steam pressure was vented off, it wasn't whirling quite as fast as it had been in the beginning. That was a little consolation, though, because it was still moving with enough force to make a shambles out of the bow deck. The Preacher watched it spin for two more revolutions. When he had it timed just right, he leapt up, ran to the bow deck, ducked at just the right moment, and reached the engine lever. The cable, without the whirling momentum of the capstan, fell into the river.
Great job, lad!
You saved our lives! We would have been killed if you hadn't gotten us out of the way!
Well, I was saving my own life, too.
Preacher's heroism elevated him, not only in the opinion of the two young women, but in the eyes of the passengers and crew as well. For the Culpepper brothers, though, it just made them more determined to take care of him before they reached St. Louis. That opportunity came on the last night before they were to reach St. Louis. Leon and Rance came out of the Grand Salon, where they had been gambling and had a run of bad luck.
I lost $20. How about you?
$35.
I know that gambler is cheating, but he's too good. I couldn't catch him at it.
Yes, I have never experienced such bad luck.
The two had stepped out to the rail to get a breath of air. Suddenly, Rance stuck his hand out to keep his brother from advancing any farther.
Brother, I think perhaps our luck is about to change.
What do you mean?
Look.
Rance pointed to the stern of the boat. There, curled up next to a stanchion, they saw Preacher. It was obvious that he was sound asleep.
You know what would be funny.
What's that?
I think it would be very funny if we just quietly walk back there and roll that son of a bitch off the boat. He'd be 3 feet underwater before he knew what happened to him.
Brother, you are a genius.
Moving quietly and staying in the shadows, the two men crept to the back of the boat. One of the side-mounted paddle wheels jerked out of sequence, as they often did. It caused the boat to make a sideways lurch. Splashed a little water on the Preacher. He opened his eyes. Just before he closed them again, he saw Leon and Rance Culpepper slipping through the shadows toward him. He wasn't sure what they were up to. They had already let him know that they considered his friendliness toward the two women to be above his station. Fairly certain that whatever the plan, they were up to no good. Leon and Rance moved out of the shadows and covered the open space between the after cabin and the stern of the boat. Leaning forward, they stuck their arms out, intending to roll Preacher over the side of the boat. Preacher reached up and grabbed their arms just as they were leaning forward. With their forward momentum already established, it was a simple maneuver for him to pull them past. Preacher stood up and looked back into the churning wake, where he saw both heads pop up.
Please wait! Please. Stop the boat! Stop the boat!
The ship.
We're in the water! Please. We fell overboard!
I cannot swim!
We are too well placed to drown!
Preacher looked around to see if anyone else had seen him go overboard, but nobody appeared to have done so. Preacher watched the brothers swim toward the bank. Reaching the shallow part of the river, they stood up, turning. Shook their fists angrily at him. Preacher saw a couple of farmhouses nearby, so he knew the brothers weren't in any mortal danger from being stranded there. They were gonna have one hell of a long walk into St. Louis. Preacher smiled and laid down again and went back to sleep. As they approached St. Louis from the river, Preacher marveled at the changes the city had undergone since he had first laid eyes on it. He had come to St. Louis the first time in 1813, and from there he had joined a regiment of volunteers to fight against the British at the Battle of New Orleans. Even though Preacher was only 14 years old, he had been brevetted a lieutenant in that battle, earning the respect of his commanders and the men who served with him. Since that time, Missouri had become a state. St. Louis had grown from a frontier town to a bustling, prosperous city of nearly 20,000 people. That was a lot of people. Too many people for someone like Preacher, who'd grown accustomed to life in the wilderness, went for days or weeks without seeing another human soul. St. Louis was a vibrant city, alive with the pulse of commerce and enterprise, the scream of steam-powered sawmills, the sound of steamboat whistles from the river, the hiss and boom of boats' engines, and the clatter of wagons rolling across cobblestone streets. To someone used to the solitude so complete that he could hear the flutter of a bird's wings, the noise of civilization was almost unbearable. Preacher hadn't planned to visit St. Louis during this trip down from the mountains, and had in fact not planned on any visit in the near future. But upon learning that his dear Jenny had been murdered, he felt that he had no choice. He had to come to find out what happened, to find justice for him. Emma and Cynthia came to the deck of the boat, preparing to leave. They were accompanied by the headmistress of the finishing school they were to attend, and followed by three young black boys who were struggling to carry their luggage.
Oh, Miss Peabody, this is Preacher.
Miss Peabody held her glasses up on a long stem and took a good, hard look at Preacher. Seeing by his dress that he was a frontiersman, she turned away from him without even acknowledging his presence.
Come, ladies, we mustn't tarry.
He saved our lives.
Miss Peabody hesitated for a moment, then turned to Preacher.
I'm sure the families of these young ladies would be more than willing to provide you with a reward for your service.
Well, thank you, ma'am, but seeing their pretty smiles is reward enough.
Come, girls, let us take our leave.
Preacher watched the women get into a beautifully lacquered carriage and drive away. He picked up the roll he kept his own gear in, tossed it over his shoulder, walked down the gangplank and up the street. A neatly painted sign on front of a building read, "Furs Bought and Sold, William Ashley, Proprietor." Squaring his shoulders, Preacher went inside. A tall, rather dignified man came up to greet him. Then, recognizing Preacher, he smiled broadly and extended his hand.
Preacher, if you aren't a sight for sore eyes.
Hello, Mr. Ashley. It's good to see you again. Ashley leaned over to see beyond Preacher.
Did you bring your own plues again?
No, I sold them to your representative out at the rendezvous.
Oh? Well then, what brings you to St. Louis? Not that I'm not pleased to see you.
Preacher pulled the letter from inside his shirt. I came because of this. The smile left Ashley's face.
About Miss Jenny?
Yeah.
Oh, to tell the truth, I rather suspected that would bring you to St. Louis.
I'd like to visit Jenny's grave. Is it marked?
Yes, I put up a marker for her.
Thank you. Where in the cemetery will I find her grave?
I don't even need to tell you that. You'll find her easily enough.
What do you mean?
Cemetery's just down at the end of the street here. Go on down there and look for yourself. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Can I leave my roll here?
Yes, of course. Go visit Jenny's grave, then come on back. We'll have dinner at Chardonnay's.
Thank you. As soon as Preacher reached the gate to the cemetery, he saw what Ashley was talking about. There, on the far side of the cemetery under a spreading maple tree, he saw a familiar-looking dog lying on one of the graves.
Dog?
Dog raised his head. Then seeing Preacher, he bounded across the cemetery toward him. Preacher dropped down on one knee. When Dog reached him, Preacher began rubbing him on the head and behind his ears, one of which he noticed was only half an ear. In addition, there were a half a dozen scars on the dog's head and body. Is that Jenny's grave over there? Dog lowered his head. Oh, I'm not accusing you, Dog. From the looks of you, you did all that you could do. Come on, take me to see Jenny. With Dog leading the way, Preacher followed through the cemetery until he reached Jenny's grave. Dog lay down. Putting his nose between his paws, he looked up at Preacher, sharing his grief. Preacher read the inscription, "Precious flower. Divine providence hath seen fit to pluck thee from this earth and transplant thee to the Garden of Eden, where a more fitting abode awaits thee. Cherished one, as long as blood flows through the veins of the hand that pens these lines, thy memory shall be kept evergreen. Gone but not forgotten, Carla."
Ah, you found Dog, I see.
Preacher sat in a chair, tipped it back against the wall, and began rubbing Dog behind his ears.
Yeah.
Did you see the inscription on the tombstone?
I saw it.
Carla had me put it there. You remember her, don't you? She was one of Jenny's girls, but not really one of her girls. Carla never was a whore.
Yeah, I remember. She's what now, 16, 17?
She's 22 now and quite a pretty woman. She's waiting tables down at Little Man's Cafe.
Mr. Ashley.
Lord, Preacher, haven't we known each other long enough for you to call me Bill?
Bill. You said you thought Ben Cavanis was one of those who killed Jenny?
That's right. Nobody saw who did it. But if I had to make a guess, he's the one I'd pick.
In the letter, you said there were two of them, but only one of them got away.
Yes.
What about the one that was caught? Haven't you been able to make him say anything?
If he does say something, he'll be saying it to God. We found him at the same time we found Miss Jenny. He's dead.
What happened to him? Ashley nodded toward Dog, who was now sleeping with his head resting on Preacher's foot.
As near as we can figure it, Dog killed him. I mean, Dog must have put up one hell of a fight.
Well, if nobody saw it and you found one man dead, how do you even know there was another one?
When we found Dog, he was more dead than alive, but he had a man's ear clenched in his teeth.
An ear?
Yes. And that ear didn't come off the dead man because he still had both his ears. That means there was another person involved.
Speaking of ears, I noticed a Dog just barely has both of his.
He also seems to have several scars.
Like I said, Dog was more dead than alive when we found him. We really didn't think he was going to live. He had a gunshot wound and 6 stab wounds. He was lying in a pool of blood, though most of it was Jenny's blood. He was lying on her body when we found him.
What was his name? The fellow who was killed, I mean. Do you know?
They called him Slater, but nobody knows if that was his first name or his last. He drifted in here about a year ago. Some say he'd been a river pirate. Others say he was just a petty thief. He was almost always in some kind of trouble, I know that. Folks all agree that Dog did the city a favor by killing him.
Yeah, I suppose. But it would have been good to talk to him to find out for sure if Cavanus was the other man.
Well, whether it was Cavanus or not, whoever did it is not in St. Louis. We know that much, at least.
How do we know that?
Because everyone in this town is wearing both their ears.
The men were quiet for a moment. Then Ashley nodded toward the Dog.
I have to tell you, I'm surprised to see him here.
Why's that?
Because this is the first time since the day Miss Jenny was buried that Dog has left the cemetery. Folks have taken notice of him, and someone is always bringing him something to eat. There are lots of rabbits and squirrels out there, and Dog is pretty resourceful. There's also a stream that runs through the place.
I wonder why he wouldn't leave the cemetery.
Oh, I don't think that's all that much of a mystery. You did leave him to look out for Miss Jenny, didn't you?
Yeah.
I think he's feeling guilty for not being able to do what you asked.
I'll be damned. You might be right. Preacher looked down at Dog. Dog opened his eyes and looked up at Preacher. Dog, you don't have anything to feel guilty about. You did the best you could do. You killed one of them, and you fixed it so that we can find the other one. I'll recognize him. Preacher reached down and rubbed Dog on the head again. You did a good job, Dog. I'm proud of you. Dog licked Preacher's hand.
You know what? I think you just took a big load off his mind. I really do think he was worried about what you'd think of him failing his responsibility.
Well, he didn't fail anything.
Nevertheless, I'll bet he won't spend all his time down at the cemetery anymore.
Listen, didn't you say something about buying me dinner?
I did. Chardonnay's just down the street. That's the best restaurant in St. Louis.
Yeah, well, I've eaten there, but if it's all the same to you, I believe as I'd just as soon eat at, where is it you said Carla works?
Little Man's.
Yeah, let's eat at Little Man's.
Preacher!
Carla was carrying a pitcher of water, and she put it down and hurried over to give Preacher a big hug. Finally, Carla drew away, and raising the end of her apron, she dabbed at her tear-filled eyes.
You know about Jenny?
Yeah. Mr. Ashley sent me a letter. I just visited her grave. That was really nice, Carla, what you had put on the gravestone.
Jenny was like a big sister to me. I never loved any person like I loved her. She loved me, too. But of course, she didn't love me the way she loved you. She was really in love with you, Preacher. Did you know that?
Yeah, I knew it.
It wasn't all one-sided, was it?
It wasn't one-sided, Carla. I did love her, even more than I thought I did. But it never would have worked out between us.
I guess not. Oh, if you visited her grave, then you saw Dog there. He won't leave it, you know.
He won't?
Mr. Ashley nodded toward the front window.
Who do you think that is?
Oh, my! There he is, on the front porch!
Yep.
But I don't understand. Ever since Jenny died, day or night, Dog has been down there lying on Jenny's grave. He never leaves the cemetery, never.
I released him.
You released him? What do you mean?
I had charged Dog with looking out for Jenny. He thought he'd failed.
The preacher told him he did all he could to protect Miss Jenny.
But I told him that. We've all told him that.
Yeah, but you weren't the one who charged him with that responsibility. Only I did that, and in Dog's mind, only I could release him from that charge.
Bless his heart. Maybe he can find peace now.
The next morning, Preacher and Dog stepped into the magistrate's office to find Constable Billen sitting in a chair with his feet propped up on his desk. He was paring an apple, and one long peel hung from it all the way to the floor. He looked up as Preacher came in.
I remember you. You're the one they call Preacher.
Uh-huh.
I expect you're here to ask about Miss Jenny. William Ashley said she was your woman.
Yeah, she was. Billings finished, then tossed the peeled apple to Preacher.
You want it? I don't particularly like apples.
Preacher looked at Billings with a confused expression on his face. You don't like apples, why'd you peel it?
Well, for the peel.
Billings stretched the long, unbroken peel out on the floor.
How long you reckon that is?
Well, I don't know, 3-4 feet maybe?
Yeah, that's pretty much what it looks like to me as well. That's not long enough.
Billings picked up the peel, then opened the door to the little pot-bellied stove and tossed it in. I beg your pardon?
You see, I've got me a $2 bet with the mayor of the town who can make the longest unbroken apple peel. He claims he can do 5 feet. We're all set to do it come Saturday.
Uh-huh. Look, about Jenny.
We found her down by the riverside. Her throat was cut. But before that, it looked like she had been beat up pretty bad. Found Slater there, too. His throat was ripped out. Figure Miss Jenny's dog did that. The dog was still Gardner. We had the devil's own tune getting to her. I reckon the dog finally decided we didn't mean her any harm.
Mr. Ashley said there was a second man, a fellow by the name of Ben Cavanaugh.
Well, now we don't know for sure that's who that was. I reckon Ashley told you the dog had a man's ear clenched in his teeth. Funny that he didn't eat it. It was almost like he wanted us to know there was someone else.
Mr. Ashley seems pretty sure it was Cavanaugh.
Well, some folks did see Cavanaugh and Slater together on the night it happened.
All right, if you know that, how come you won't say for sure that the one who got away was Cavanaugh?
Because we don't have no actual witnesses to the killing, except for that dog there. And it's kind of hard to identify someone by his ear.
You still have it?
Have what, the ear?
Yeah.
Now, just what in the Sam Hill makes you think I'd hang on to something like that?
Do you still have it?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Billings walked over to a chest and pulled out a drawer.
I dried it out in the sun so it wouldn't rot away.
I'd like it, please.
And what are you aiming to do with it?
As soon as I find Cavanaugh, I aim to sew this ear back on his head. Then I aim to kill him.
Well, sounds reasonable enough.
Billings handed the sun-blackened piece of leather to Preacher.
You might want this as well.
Billings took an envelope from the drawer. What is that?
It's everything I've got on Miss Jenny. Complaints she made and complaints made against her. I don't know that it'll do you any good, but I got no need to be keeping it now, so it's yours if you want it.
All right. Thanks. Preacher started toward the door.
Preacher.
Yeah?
The man you're looking for, whether it's Cavanaugh or someone else, ain't in St. Louis. I'm pretty sure about that. If he is here and you find him and kill him, well, I just want you to know that you won't be having no trouble with me or the law. Seeing as any son of a bitch who would do something like that needs killing pure and simple. But if you find him in some other town and you kill him there, then you might have some explaining to do.
Yeah, I know.
What I'm saying is, once you leave St. Louis, there won't be nothing I can do to help you.
I know it.
Just so as you understand.
In the shadowed interior of LaBarge's tavern, Preacher ordered a beer, then sat at a table in the back. Dog curled himself onto the floor beside Preacher's chair.
Folks don't normally bring dogs into the saloon.
You want him out, you run him out. LaBarge looked at Dog curled up on the floor.
You, out! No dogs allowed in here!
Dog made no effort to respond. LaBarge came around from behind the bar.
I said, get out of here!
LaBarge took a couple of steps toward Dog and stopped dead in his tracks.
I guess you can stay.
Preacher had paid no attention to what was going on between Dog and LaBarge. Instead, he busied himself with dumping the contents of the envelope out on the table. Examining the little pile, Preacher found the document written in Jenny's neat hand.
I, Jenny, do hereby file this complaint against Mr. Ben Cavanaugh. Last night, while returning home from a job I was doing for Mrs. Sybil Abernathy, Mr. Ben Cavanaugh jumped out of an alley in front of me. I believe it was his intention to attack me, but my dog ran him off.
There was also a complaint filed against the River Bank of St. Louis and Theodore Epson for failing to credit her mortgage payment. In addition, there were several documents that had been filed against Jenny. These were much older, the oldest being 6 years old, the newest one almost 2 years old. All of these had been filed by Mrs. Sybil Abernathy. The gist of Mrs. Abernathy's complaints was that Jenny was a prostitute, and the practice of her profession prevented St. Louis from realizing its potential as a city of culture and influence. There was also a letter in the file from Theodore Epson, responding to an inquiry made by Constable Billings.
Mr. Theodore Epson, Chief Teller, Trust Bank of Philadelphia. Dear Constable Billings, I assure you, sir, that any suspicion you may have that I absconded with cash due the bank is totally without merit. The woman in question, known only as Jenny, was indeed in debt to the Riverbank of St. Louis for the mortgage held on her home. In point of fact, her home was not a private residence, as she claimed in her loan application. It was, instead, used as a house of ill repute. Thus, you can see that if a case of fraud is to be made, it should rightfully be made against her for misrepresenting herself in securing the loan. I cannot believe that anyone would take seriously the accusations of a whore against a respectable banker. Sincerely, Theodore Epson.
Preacher?
Looking up, Preacher saw Carla coming toward him. Generally, only bar girls and women of the street plying their profession would enter a saloon. But Carla was very much at ease in LaBarge's tavern. She was not and had never been a prostitute, but in her younger days she had worked as a bar girl in this very establishment. Carla, what are you doing here?
I thought I would... Well, I mean, if you don't have other plans, I thought I might cook supper for you.
Cook supper for me where?
Jenny and I shared a small house over on Olive. Well, actually in the alley behind Olive. I'd be happy to cook dinner for you tonight.
Oh, you don't have to cook for me, Carla. We could have dinner at Little Man's.
I work at Little Man's. Sometimes I just want to get out of there.
Oh, yeah, well, I guess I can understand that. All right. How about if we have dinner at Chardonnay's?
Oh, why, Preacher, one would think you don't want my home cooking.
No, nothing like that. I'm just trying to keep you from going to any trouble for me, that's all.
You don't know anything about women, do you, Preacher?
Not much.
Sometimes women want to go to the trouble of fixing dinner.
All right, if you put it that way, I'll be glad to come.
About 7?
7 would be fine. After leaping off the boat, Cavanis managed to swim ashore, though he nearly drowned in the process. Cavanis lay on the riverbank for several minutes, trying to get his breath back. He had not considered the fact that someone might be looking for him. No one saw him kill Jenny, so how would they know it was him? Finally, Cavanis stood and hitched up his pants. When he did, he suddenly realized that he had lost his knife. Then he discovered that he had lost all of his money as well. He looked back toward the river. Evidently, it had fallen from his pocket when he jumped into the water. The money was in bills issued by the Bank of the United States. It was paper money, not coin, which meant that the money was probably scattered all down the river by now.
Son of a bitch! Son of a bitch! Son of a bitch! Son of a bitch!
Cavanis crawled to the top of the bank. From there, he could see the boat moving majestically downriver, its chimneys belching smoke, the paddles slapping into the water, churning a wake that followed behind. He had no real idea where he was, and he was wet, cold, hungry, and broke. Now he had to get to Philadelphia. He began following the river south. That night, he saw a flatboat that had put in for the night. There were 2 men operating the boat, and he watched as they made it fast and built a fire for their supper. The smell of the food made his stomach growl, but he stayed hidden until both were asleep. Then, sneaking down to the boat, he slipped the rope from the tree and pushed it out into the stream. The current caught him and started him downriver at a fairly good clip. All that night and the next day, he rowed the boat downriver. He let Cape Girardeau pass by because he knew the steamboat was going to stop there, and he was afraid they might know about him. The next town south was the small town of Commerce, so he put in there. Commerce consisted of no more than a dozen buildings, all parallel with the river's edge. When he landed, a man came down to take the rope and make the boat fast for him.
Howdy. The name is Farrell. I own a store here. What is it that you're carrying?
Axes, shovels, iron stoves.
Cavanis had examined the cargo during the trip down.
Are you looking to sell it here, or do you plan on going down to New Madrid?
Well, I'll sell it here.
Because, you know, I can't pay as much as they do down at New Madrid.
What can you pay me?
Well, Let me take a look here.
All the while Farrell was poking through the cargo, he kept glancing up at Cavanus. Cavanus knew that he was looking at the wound left by the missing ear. Had the boat stopped here as well? Did this man know who he was? Finally, he could take it no longer.
What the hell are you looking at, mister?
I'm sorry. I know that ain't good manners to stare at something like that. I'm just wondering how you come by a wound like that.
I was bit by a bear.
I'm sorry I was staring at you. I know it's rude.
How much will you give me for all this?
Well, I figure I can pay you $100, like I said. You'd probably get more for it down in New Madrid, but I'll give you $100 for it.
I'll take it.
This would replace the money he lost when he jumped into the river.
All right. Just bring your bill of lading on up to my store and I'll pay you.
Farrell stepped off the boat and headed toward the scattering of buildings.
Bill of lading? I don't have no bill of lading.
You don't have a bill of lading?
No.
In truth, Cavanus didn't even know if he had one or not because he wasn't sure what it was.
Mister, how'd you come by those goods if you don't have a bill of lading?
I won the boat and everything on it in a card game.
Where?
Up in St. Genevieve. If you'll just give me the $100, I'll be on my way.
Can't do that.
What do you mean you can't? Why not?
Mister, you may not know this, but time was when we had river pirates, something awful. Now, they're most cleaned out now, but every now and then, there's outlaws will prey on the boats coming down river. So now it's a law. Anything we buy off a boat has to have a bill of lading. If you don't have one, I can't buy your goods.
I'll sell it all to you for $50.
Mister, I wouldn't give you $25 for it. Like as not, the man you won it from stole it off somebody.
Farrell walked away from the boat.
$10! You can have the whole load for $10!
Farrell stopped, then looked back toward Cavanus.
Mister, I'm going to get the constable. He might want to talk to you about that man you won that from.
Cavanus had no desire to talk to the constable. So as Farrell walked away, he slipped the rope free and pushed back into the stream. He reached the confluence of the Mississippi and Ohio the next afternoon, and there he abandoned the boat on the Illinois side. From there, he started following the Ohio River. About every other day or so, he'd see boats going upriver, but he was afraid to take passage on one of them for fear they might be looking for him. If it hadn't been for that damn dog chewing off his ear, he could have boarded any one of the boats and no one would have been the wiser. But if they were looking for someone with a chewed off ear, that would make it pretty hard for him to blend in. He wasn't sure if the news had spread to the small towns along the river. There was a good chance that it had. After all, the boats were making better time than he was, and news like that was generally the first thing folks would talk about. When he abandoned the boat, he took the rest of the food with him, but it ran out after a few days. He had one day of absolute hunger, then happened onto a field of potatoes and dug up several of them. Those sustained him for the next several days. Then he was drawn to a travel camp by the smell of smoke from the fire. Advancing just to the edge of the golden bubble of light, Cavanus stayed in the darkness. That way, he could see but not be seen. There was only one man in the camp, an older man from the looks of his white hair and beard. The man had no idea that he was being examined, but his horse sensed the presence of a stranger.
Hello? Anyone out there?
Hello to the camp. Can I come in?
Sure. Come on in. I got enough stew for two. I'd enjoy the company.
Well, thanks.
You got your own pan?
No.
No matter. We can get a piece of bark to use as a plate. Have a... God's name, man. What happened to your ear?
I had a run-in with a bear.
Bear? In Ohio?
Back in Missouri.
Oh, my. You were lucky to survive.
Finding a flat piece of birch bark, the man spooned up some of the stew, then handed it over to Cavanus.
I don't reckon you have a fork or a spoon either.
No, but this'll do.
Cavanus held up a smaller piece of bark and began using it as a spoon.
If you don't mind my asking, how's it that you're traveling with none of the things you need?
I was traveling by boat, and the boat sank and I lost everything.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Where are you headed?
Philadelphia.
Big town, Philadelphia. My name is Seagraves, Milton Seagraves. I'm on my way to Cincinnati to take a job with a newspaper. What's your line of work?
Whatever I can get. You know, I'm sort of a handyman.
Well, if you're willing to work, I'm sure there'll be plenty of jobs for you in a city as big as Philadelphia.
You carrying a gun?
A gun? Heavens, no. Why should I carry a gun? Ohio is civilized country.
I just thought you might have one.
No siree. I don't own one, and I don't intend to ever own one. I don't hold much with guns. I do have a knife, though.
Seagraves pulled the knife from his belt. It was a good-sized knife, much like the one Cavanaugh had used to kill Jenny, and the one he had lost in the river.
Good stew. I appreciate the invite.
You're mighty welcome. Like I said, I enjoy the company.
The fire's getting low.
That's all right. About time to turn in anyway.
Well, I see a good-sized chunk of wood over there. I'll get it and throw just one more piece on the fire.
Go ahead. If we're going to talk a while longer, we may as well be looking at each other while we're doing it.
Cavanaugh walked over to pick up the piece of wood. It was about 3 feet long and 3 or 4 inches in diameter. In truth, it wasn't a very good piece for burning at all, but it was an excellent piece for Cavanaugh's use.
So, tell me about that bear.
Seagraves didn't bother turning toward Cavanaugh, who was now coming up behind Seagraves' back.
How did he happen to chaw off an ear without taking off your head? That's a story I'd like to hear.
The blow crushed the side of Seagraves' head, and he fell forward into the fire. The next morning, Seagraves was still belly down, with his head in the ashes of what had been the previous night's fire. His head was turned to one side, and the bottom of his face was burned away, so that what flesh was left was blackened and disfigured. Amazingly, the top half of his face was undamaged. Cavanaugh found a change of clothes that were somewhat less conspicuous than the clothes he was wearing, so he changed. Then, saddling Seagraves' horse, he rode off. 2 days later, when he smelled pork chops frying, Cavanaugh determined to find its source. Riding through a cornfield, he came upon a small farmhouse, the origin of the enticing aroma. Dismounting, Cavanaugh tied the horse off, then using trees and bushes to mask his approach, eased up to the house. Looking through the window, he saw a man sitting in a chair, smoking a pipe and reading a book. In addition to the man, there were two women standing at the stove. As he examined them more closely, he saw that one of the women was very young, perhaps no more than 15 or 16 years old.
Papa, supper's about ready.
All right, Missy. I'll sit at the table since I finish reading this page.
Go get Billy, Susie.
Nodding, Susie opened the back door. From his position of observation through the window, Cavanaugh saw that the man was sitting with his back to the door Susie had just used. That was good. That meant that the door would be unlocked because Susie had just gone through it. And as Susie's father's back was to the door, Cavanaugh would be able to sneak in without being seen. Moving quietly, and with the knife he had taken from Seagraves in his hand, Cavanaugh opened the door and slipped inside.
Well, that didn't take long.
The man didn't even turn around. Cavanaugh stepped up behind the chair, then drew the knife across the man's throat.
Hiram, what was that? What just fell?
Cavanaugh stepped quickly to one side of the door and waited for the woman to come back into the room.
Hiram?
With the bloody knife still in his hand, Cavanaugh walked over to the table where he picked up a pork chop and began eating. As soon as the girl came back, Cavanaugh would take care of her, though not before he had a little fun with her. Then he would search the house for a gun, any money they might have, and some extra food. Maybe a blanket or a quilt would be nice, too. Outside the house, 17-year-old Billy Potter was using a pitchfork to toss hay in the feeding trough when Susie came to get him.
Billy, Mama says get washed up for supper.
What we having?
Pork chops, and I helped.
You cooked them, they're probably poison.
Well, if you don't like them, you don't have to eat them.
Oh, I'll eat them all right. I won't like them, but I'll eat them.
Finished with the hay, Billy walked over to the well where he drew out some water and poured it into a basin.
Billy, are you going to the county fair this Saturday?
Yep.
Will you take me?
Who wants to go to a country fair with little sister hanging around him all the time?
Little sister? I'm near as old as you are. And I'm almost a woman, full grown now.
Yeah, that's what I'm afraid of. You'll go sparking with all the boys and I'm the one getting in trouble for letting you do it.
I won't.
You will too. You're the biggest tease in the whole county.
Oh, you make me so mad.
Susie grabbed the pan of water and started to toss it on Billy.
No, wait. You can go. I was just teasing.
Promise?
I promise.
Susie put the water pan down and Billy grabbed it.
I'll show you to threaten me.
No!
Susie ran back up to the house with Billy chasing her.
Mama, Billy's going to...
There, on the floor of the kitchen, lay Susie's mother and dad, both with their throats cut. The most terrifying-looking human being Susie had ever seen was standing there over them, holding a pork chop in one hand and a bloody knife in the other.
What's... Susie, run!
Billy pulled Susie back outside and gave her a shove. Billy turned and ran with her. Reaching the barn, Billy grabbed the pitchfork he had been working with, then turned back. Cavanis had come as far as the kitchen door to chase him, but when he saw the boy with a pitchfork, he had second thoughts. He didn't have a gun, all he had was a knife. Even though this was just a boy, the kid was nearly full grown. In a fight between a knife and a pitchfork, the pitchfork would always win. Turning back through the kitchen, Cavanis grabbed a couple more pork chops, then ran out the front door and headed for his horse. The boy came bursting out of the front door onto the porch.
You son of a bitch! You bastard! You killed my pa!